MacCast, Sunday, June 24th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you had a wonderful and pleasant weekend. I'm reaching the end of mine. It was actually quite nice and relaxing. Not a whole lot going on. Maybe some of you are getting out and enjoying the summer. We just passed the first day of summer, actually, a couple days ago as I record this. So maybe you're out camping or fishing or hiking or running or jogging or I don't know, whatever people do in the summer. Hanging out at the beach, I guess, is another good one. Something we do here a lot in Southern California. But I hope you're having a great time. And I hope you are ready to get into some Apple and Mac news, because we've got a few things to cover. We're going to talk about Apple Pay expansion. We're going to talk about Apple Video expansion in the worldwide video area, of course. We're also going to talk about wireless keys and wireless power, and whether or not you might be able to learn an instrument over the summer and how Apple might help you out with that. And we'll also talk about sticky keys. I guess we got a couple of stories about keys in the news this week. And then after that, we're going to get to some of your feedback. I got a lot of great feedback on the Mac hardware cycle to share with you. Also, I'm going to share some information about how iCloud Drive works a little bit. We had a question about that. And also get into some DVD ripping, something I had to do recently. And I'm going to share with you my workflow for doing that. And then we're going to talk a little bit about playlist shifting. And I have a good little recommendation from a member of our community on that. So it should be a great episode. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. Smile's been a sponsor here on the MacCast for forever. We love them. And we have to say happy birthday to them, because actually June 12th, to be specific, was Smile's 15th birthday, basically making 15 years, excuse me, of making awesome products and software for the Mac and Apple community, and of course now iOS devices, but we didn't have those back 15 years ago. Also providing great customer service and just being all around great members of the Apple community. As a matter of fact, PDF Pen 1.0 debuted at Macworld in San Francisco way back in 2004, still when they had Macworlds. And now we're all the way up to version 10. Actually, a new version just came out. If you haven't upgraded yet and you're a PDF Pen customer, you definitely should grab this upgrade. It's a really good one. If you don't have PDF Pen, well, now's a great time to pick it up, because we all have to deal with PDFs, right? You have to use PDFs in this day and age. I don't think you can escape them. You're going to come across one at one point, and at one point, you're going to want to be able to work with that. You're going to want to edit it. Maybe you're going to want to fill out a form. Maybe you're going to want to add a signature to it. Myriad of other things. Maybe you just want to be able to search it and find things, or take a PDF that's not searchable and make it searchable. OCR, all that sort of stuff. And PDF Pen allows you to do all of that. In PDF Pen 10, they've added new features like watermarking, support for headers and footers. There's a new precision editing tool that is really, really cool. And with PDF Pen Pro 10, you get batch OCR. That makes doing bulk OCR really super easy. And they just released an update already to version 10. 10.1 adds AppleScript support for the new features, including the batch OCR features in PDF Pen Pro. So you can now script that stuff and work that into your workflows. Right now, or actually back on the week of June 11th, the guys at Smile, Greg, and the folks over there posted a bunch of great blog posts kind of looking back at Smile's history. There's a lot of cool, fun, nostalgic posts up there for Mac geeks, rather. And members of the MacCast community. You should check those out for sure. Just visit smilesoftware.com/blog to join in on the fun. And there's actually a post up there where you can get yourself some free Smile stickers. They're doing a sticker giveaway, and it's pretty easy. You just got to send them an envelope, self-addressed, stamped, so they can send you back some stickers. So take advantage of that. And also just be sure to visit smilesoftware.com/podcast for more information on PDF Pen 10. And while you're there, check out their other great applications too, like Text Expander. Yeah, you can't live without that one. So big, big congratulations to Smile on 15 years of making great Mac software and just being all around generally great people in our community. And a big thank you to them again for their support of the MacCast. And go, please support them. Let them know. Wish them a happy birthday. Tell them you heard about it here on the MacCast. And yeah, just say thanks, because them supporting us allows me to actually do this show. And I really do appreciate it. Smilesoftware.com/podcast. Apple Pay has been rolling out in more and more countries. As a matter of fact, last time on the MacCast, I told you about Poland, Apple Pay coming to Poland. Well, just a day after that, thus is the nature of doing a podcast only once a week, right? The very next day, they actually rolled it out in Norway as well. Yeah, my people, that's my ancestry. Goes all the way back to Norway. I'm actually half Norwegian, so my compatriots over there, you're getting Apple Pay. Apple Pay is supported by three financial institutions. Santander Consumer Finance, which I guess is one of the largest banks in the region. Nordea and Sbanken. So those three institutions, I think most of them are supporting Visa. I believe only one of them currently supports MasterCard. So depending upon your card and which bank you're using, you may or may not be able to get Apple Pay support, but at least it's rolled out there. And we've also had a few other rumors and indications that Apple Pay may be launching soon in the Czech Republic, probably by about August. So within the next few months, we could see an Apple Pay announcement in the Czech Republic. But Apple continues to push forward on Apple Pay internationally. And I think for a lot of Apple fans, maybe it can't come to your country soon enough, but hopefully it'll get there eventually. I think they do want to get it out everywhere. I'm sure they have a vested interest in doing that. But another few countries rolled out over the past couple weeks, and we expect more soon. Let's get into Apple Worldwide Video. Yep, it's the entertainment section that has become the norm here on the MacCast. Actually, this week I'm super excited to tell you about what happened. Variety reported that Apple is doing a deal with Sesame Workshop to create a whole slate of kids programming for its Worldwide Video division. Now, Sesame Workshop is the non-profit educational organization behind Sesame Street, you know. Few people like that show, right? Now, Apple's not going to be licensing Sesame Street exactly. As a matter of fact, not at all, because that's already kind of licensed out to HBO and PBS, of course, has for years. And this deal for Apple is actually for multiple original shows and will include live action and animated series. And in addition, at least one series, a puppet series, developed exclusively for Apple. So this is going to be exclusive Apple content produced and put together by Sesame Workshop. And it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. I can imagine animated series. They did a bunch of those when I was growing up in the 80s. I think Muppet Babies was one of them that aired on Saturday mornings. I remember that. That was a little past my time. I'm probably aging myself or pointing out my age here. I'm old, folks. Let me just tell you that. I'm getting older every day. But I'm excited, again, about this content. Apple is signing up some amazing people. And as a matter of fact, 9to5Mac highlighted a pretty insightful tweet from Ben Beharin about Apple's video strategy. Basically, he was citing the value of betting on good quality content, which is really what Apple's doing here. They are focused on the quality. And he said, that's going to work because not only do you have longevity of that content, right? The content is evergreen. It kind of doesn't die out, especially if it's really good stuff, good classic stuff. So once Apple's done with it, he's alluding, hey, they could sell it off to another network. And I found that interesting because that's basically syndication. We're used to that, right? A lot of shows show up in syndication. They are very profitable in syndication. What's funny to me about this is typically video services like Netflix and Amazon, a big part of their catalog is that older stuff, stuff that they license. And the idea that this would be sort of flipped around and these services would start licensing their original content back to TV networks is an interesting proposition. Do you think that'll really happen, or has TV or will TV and video have changed so much that that's not even really a viable option? Ben Maharin thinks it is, and he's a pretty smart guy. So at least maybe in the short term, that's another potential profit center for Apple. So Apple investing in original series and original video content that's exclusive to their network has a couple different benefits. And that was one that I guess probably should have been obvious, but maybe I didn't really think about until now. So it's interesting to think about. What are your thoughts on that? And then one other series Apple has reportedly given an order for is something created by Canal Plus over in France. Apple has tapped them to create an English language adaptation of their short form video series called Calls. excuse me. Wow, I cracked like Peter Brady there. Anyway, it's called Calls. The episodes are about 10 minutes in length and combine real-life audio with minimal video. And the stories seem to fit into this kind of true-life crime drama genre that's gotten pretty popular, especially on podcasts in the audio form. It's increasingly popular, so I guess it kind of leverages that sort of thing, and they're going to produce a bunch of these for Apple. What's interesting is the short form format to me of these, 10 minutes in length, probably 10 episodes, seems like something that would be more suited for release on Apple Music. That's the kind of thing and video things that Apple is doing on the Apple Music service. So I'm not entirely convinced maybe that this one is for their upcoming video subscription service, but we'll just have to wait and see. But that's kind of the latest on what's happening with Apple Worldwide Video. With the Wallet app a few years ago, Apple started the process of maybe eventually replacing your wallet with your iPhone. Now it looks like they might be moving on to try and replace your car keys. Apple apparently is a member of the Car Connectivity Consortium, which is an organization focused on enabling seamless mobile device to vehicle connectivity. I would imagine they're part of that group and in large part because of their work with AirPlay. But this week, the group, which includes other companies like Samsung, LG, GM, Audi, and BMW, they released a new digital key specification, version 1.0, and the spec creates a standardized solution to allow a digital vehicle key to be loaded onto a smartphone and then used via NFC to do a number of common things you'd use a key for, like unlock the car, lock the car, start the engine, and a driver could also share a key digitally with another driver. So imagine kind of applications for things like car rentals and car sharing and those sort of things, basically allowing keyless operation of the vehicle. So it has a lot of personal advantages, but also some commercial and other advantages. Now, right now, version one, the version that's being released this week, does require a dealer to transfer the digital key to your phone, but the report says the consortium is already working on version 2, where they hope to have better interoperability between different smart devices and vehicles. It also looks like that might open up the ability for the end user to basically generate a key for themselves and kind of handle that process so you're not just tied into the dealer doing it. Some car manufacturers like Audi are actually already using the system, so it's out there in deployment, and that sounds pretty cool. You know, the ability to kind of replace all this extra stuff with your phone. I guess the only dilemma is for those folks who tend to lose or misplace their phone. If you've got your wallet on there, your keys on there, and your phone on there, you know, and it's your phone, that becomes a pretty vital, important piece of your life. Luckily, I guess we have Find My iPhone. So it's a little bit easier to find an iPhone, I think, than it is your car keys or that sort of thing. But anyway, I think that's pretty cool. I'd like to be able to just have my phone in my pocket, be able to walk up, unlock my car, hop in and drive and not have to worry about carrying a bunch of keys around. So I look forward to the day when that's kind of the standard and the reality. And since this is our only iPhone related story this week, I'm going to take this section or this moment as a time to slot in one other iPhone related bit of news, a little minor one, but it looks like Apple's getting ready to go into production on their A12 series processors. DigiTimes says TSMC has ramped up production of Apple's A12 series processors, and they're using their new advanced 7-nanometer process. And there have been rumors that that process was being impacted by, as we typically hear, slower than expected or lower yield rates. And during the announcement of the ramp up, TSMC's CEO addressed those rumors, saying that the overall capacity in 2018 of their 7-nanometer process is expected to be about 12 million wafers. That's actually going to be up 1.5 million from 2017 levels. So we can expect that they're not going to have as many issues, or they're at least alluding, saying that they are not going to have as many issues. So there should be plenty of iPhone processors to go around this year. And they're also getting ready with their 5-nanometer node technology, but that's not expected to reach mass production until the end of 2019. So that means that Apple is going to be stuck with the 7-nanometer process probably for 2 years now. Not that that's a bad thing, but they're not going to be moving to the next gen technology till the end of 2019. So A13, expect that to also be on the 7-nanometer process. All right, remember way back when in September, Apple had a little event. They announced some products and devices, a little something called the iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and iPhone 10. And at the end of that presentation, they also announced a new wireless charging product. Since all those new products were supporting wireless charging, Apple was going to bring us something called the Air Power Mat, or Air Power. It was a 3-in-1 wireless charging mat that had the ability to wirelessly charge your iPhone 8, 8 Plus, or iPhone 10, along with an Apple Watch, the third generation Apple Watch, and also your AirPods, once Apple brought out a new wireless charging case that they also told us they were going to sell. Really cool stuff, really interesting technology. A lot of people got excited about it. And to date, we have not seen hide nor hair of that, nor have we heard very much about it other than the fact that it wasn't out yet. Well, this week, Bloomberg claims that Apple hoped to have that product here this month, around Worldwide Developer Conference, but ran into a little bit of trouble with heat, also the multi-device charging circuitry, and a few little software bugs. So basically, not ready to ship it quite yet. They stepped back from it a little bit and thought we need a little bit more time. And it's not surprising, because this thing turns out is a lot more than just a dumb charging mat. It actually is a smart one. Quite a few bit of smarts are in there. According to the Bloomberg report, it has a custom Apple chip, something that Apple has been apt to do lately. Almost every one of their products has some sort of new Apple-designed silicon. And it actually runs a stripped-down version of iOS, they say, to manage the power and the charging circuits, as well as handle communication with your devices. So the power management communication, I would assume. And one cool thing about this mat also that is a little bit different because there are some other like multiple device wireless charging products out on the market, Qi chargers, but they still all have little hot zones or hot spots where you've got to get the inductive coil lined up in the right way on the pad to make it work. The promise of the Air Power is that no matter where you put it on the mat, it will charge your devices. You don't have to be so exact. As long as it's sitting on the mat, place objects anywhere, and the pad will be able to charge them. So that whole, all that combination of technologies is what's taking a little bit longer than expected for Apple to get this up and running. Now, Bloomberg claims that right now, some of Apple's engineers are already using the mats in their offices, which means they're getting close, and they say the new target date for release is supposedly September this year. I would imagine Apple would make the announcement at this year's iPhone announcement saying, here's the new range of iPhones, they have wireless charging, and now the Air Power Mat is ready to ship. Of course, it's a full year after Apple announced the thing, but to be fair, at the event, when they did make the pre-announcement, Apple only promised it, quote, next year. So they are going to get it out this year. And technically, that's not delayed. But problem was, I think many folks were looking at this thing as an accessory and figured it wouldn't be that far off, especially if Apple was taking the time to announce it at a special event. So a lot of us thought it would get here sooner than later. Looks like it's turning out to be later, but it still should be a pretty cool product at launch. We don't have any details on what it will cost still. I'm still of the belief that it's going to be in the $150 to $200 range. And that sounds expensive, but if you look at high-end wireless chargers and three of them, which is essentially what you're getting in there, that's about the same cost, and you're getting a little smarter technology, so you're going to pay a little bit of a premium for that. So I'm guessing $149. I'd be surprised if it was up to $199, but not too surprised, to be honest. But we'll have to wait and see. It'd be great if it came in at like $99. I think they'd sell a lot more of them. And another cool thing about this technology is Apple has also promised to release the multi-device technology back to the Qi standards body. So there's hope that there could be third-party products that would incorporate this tech as well. But Apple, of course, needs to get theirs out on the market first before any of that will ever happen. And the piece also, one other thing that came out of this piece, it also mentions that Apple did have some intentions of maybe trying to remove the wired charging option from the iPhone X design. So they had thought about removing the Lightning port from the iPhone X. And this is a rumor that's been floating around recently for future iPhones, probably not even this year's models, but maybe the 2019 models, that Apple would go totally wireless, no ports on them, no Lightning connector whatsoever. And that does seem to kind of confirm at least Apple's thought on this, that they were trying to get that for the iPhone X, ultimately decided that wireless charging wasn't quite fast enough, certainly not as fast as the fast charging on the iPhone. And we are expected this year to get the fast USB-C charger with that 18-watt adapter. I think we talked about that in the last episode of the MacCast. So not doable yet, but I would imagine in the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see iPhones without any kind of Lightning physical connector port for charging or syncing on it whatsoever. So just prepare yourself for that now, because I know there's going to be an uproar from the tech community when Apple makes that decision, just like every time Apple does something like, oh, I don't know, what was it this year? The notch? Yeah. There's always some sort of rage that happens, because that's like what we like to do in the tech media. And not me personally, but you know, that's how it goes. All right, I think this is the, we got two more things for you. One real quick thing, and I only wanted to point this out. I typically don't talk about software updates too much, but Apple released an update to GarageBand this week. 10.3 is out, and I wouldn't normally cover a story like this, but in this update, there's a thing that makes it a little more fun than some other updates. And no, it's not the 1,000 new electronic and urban loops, nor the new drummers or new sound effects, voice effects, animal effects, all of those things. Yes, very, very cool, neat stuff. But that's not it. No, what Apple did this time around is they took the built-in artist lessons and made them 100% free in 120 countries. Now, formerly, these would cost you about $4.99 US each. There are 8 video piano lessons and 15 video guitar lessons, and they're taught by famous artists like Sarah McLachlan, Sting, John Fogerty, Fall Out Boy. Yeah, and Apple announced that, oh man, a while back, but now you can get them for free. So once you update to the latest version of GarageBand, if you'd like to learn guitar or piano, all those lessons, basically $115 worth of them, are there for you now for free. So I thought that was pretty cool and a very nice thing for Apple to do. I don't know how many of those lessons maybe they were still selling anymore. I think a lot of people had forgotten they were even there. Did you forget they were there? Well, go check them out. No, they're actually really well done. I remember checking them out when Apple first released it. I think they had one free version of the piano lessons and one free version of the guitar lessons. But now you can get them all for free. And then lastly, in the news for this week, the MacBook Pro keyboard sticky, broken, repeating keys issue that we have talked about on the MacCast probably for several of the episodes this year, probably since the keyboards came out. Apple has never formally acknowledged the issue or problem until now. This Friday, Apple announced an official extended repair and service program to address what they call a, quote, small percentage of users who might experience sticky, repeated key characters or unresponsive keys on their MacBook or MacBook Pro. The program actually covers Retina 12-inch MacBook Pro models from early 2015 to 2017 and 13 and 15-inch MacBook Pro models from 2016 and 2017. And I know several of you have run into this issue, so now Apple is officially covering it for anyone who might have the problem. And the program is going to cover eligible MacBook and MacBook Pro models for 4 years from the date of purchase, and that's regardless of your AppleCare coverage. So you will be covered on that. Apple says customers experiencing issues can have their Macs serviced for free of charge through Apple stores or an Apple authorized service provider. And also, if you're one of those customers who already paid for service for the keys, the key issue on an eligible product, you are also going to be eligible for a refund. And as far as what Apple's going to do, they say depending upon the severity and what the issue is, the repair might involve the replacement of one or more individual keys or the entire keyboard. And that statement has caused a little bit more controversy because some have pointed out that while this is a good step in the right direction in terms of good customer faith and customer service, it really doesn't address what many feel is the underlying fatal design issue of the keyboard itself. And I don't know how Apple would do that in an aftermarket capacity. I have heard that they've made some tweaks to the design, but I would imagine that would involve replacing the entire keyboard. And that has, to date, just really been a rumor. And this announcement doesn't seem to back up that rumor. It does sound like Apple's just repairing the existing keyboard design with similar technology, which means potentially those repaired keys could eventually fail again. And I guess getting your faulty keyboard repaired for up to 4 years for free, you can keep taking it in. I don't think there's any limit on the number of times they'll actually repair it. But that's just kind of a pain in the butt. And if you're constantly having to get it repaired over and over again, then really what's the point, right? If it's constantly in for service, then you don't really have the computer to use. So I'm not sure that this really solves the problem. The big thing here is Apple actually acknowledging that there is an issue. Again, they're saying it's limited, and I have to say that's confirmed by the small survey we did here on the MacCast. I asked you to write in if you've had this issue or haven't had this issue, and I would say I got a little more people saying they haven't run into the issue. I had a couple of people who said, yeah, I had it one time, but Apple fixed it, and I haven't had an issue since. And then there were a couple of you who, unfortunately, it seemed, got kind of the lemon computers and had to have your keyboard serviced two or maybe even three times. So I don't know if this program is going to address any of that, but at least you should have less hassle when going into the Apple retail store to get service, because Apple is fully aware and acknowledges the issue at this point. So that happened this week, and that was kind of big news, probably the biggest news story of the week. So maybe I buried the lead a little bit. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast, somebody I had hoped would be a sponsor at some point, and we are so happy to have them here, 1Password. I don't know if I can gush enough about how awesome 1Password is. I've been a 1Password user for years. I learned my lesson when my Yahoo account got hacked. If you don't know what 1Password is, it is a password management application. It allows you to store all of your passwords and a whole lot more. You can actually put any kind of information in there that you want to keep safe. So credit card numbers, loyalty reward cards, addresses, credit cards, anything that you want to keep safe, you can put into 1Password and have access to it when and where you need it, because you can access it on the Mac, you can access it on the web, you can access it on your iOS devices, your Android devices, your Windows machines. It's all there. You can put all of your account logins, you can have it autofill credit card details, all in one click, and they provide instant syncing, which allows you to have that data across all your devices whenever you need it. And they're constantly adding new features. They recently added a new feature called Watchtower, which will actually tell you, you know, we hear about data breaches every day. It will actually tell you if any of your passwords in your 1Password database have been compromised, if they're vulnerable or if they're just weak or maybe reused passwords. You can identify all of that stuff, and then you can quickly make changes. It makes it very easy to go to the website, update those passwords, and make them more secure. And speaking of more secure, you know, after I had my incident with my Yahoo password getting hacked, the problem was exactly that. I had used the same password on multiple services, what you're not supposed to do. And of course, I did it because it was convenient, right? I didn't want to have to remember multiple passwords. Well, 1Password gets past all that. And that's why I love it. And that's why I use it. I now use a unique 24 character, totally randomly generated password generated. And that's another great feature of 1Password, the random password generation, right? It creates the password for you, a secure one, different for every website, automatically logs that into the database. And when you're browsing around in the browser, there's a simple plugin. You just have it autofill right out of 1Password, and you only have to remember your 1Password password. Another huge feature they added recently that I absolutely love too, two-factor authentication support. So you can put those little codes, you know, the QR code you have to do for two-factor authentication. They usually want you to have a separate app like, you know, Google Authenticator. You don't need a separate app. You just use 1Password, and it integrates. It will even auto-copy when you're logging into a website. It will auto-copy that code to your clipboard, so you just have to paste it in, and away you go. The features just go on and on. End-to-end encryption, of course, keeps all your data safe when it's going from your Mac to your iPhone and back again. They also have awesome customer service that's available 24/7. And best of all, here's the deal. Because you're a MacCast listener, you're going to get 3 months of 1Password for free by visiting 1Password.com/MacCast. So now you really have no reason not to be using 1Password. You should be using it already. But now, no reason not to use it. Use it for free. 3 months. That'll convince you that you can't live without it. I guarantee you. And just head to 1Password.com/MacCast. And a huge, huge thank you. And to 1Password for supporting the show. And we love having them here. Great, great product. Every Mac owner, iPhone owner, in my opinion, should have it. So 1Password.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to them for their support. Okay, let's talk about that Mac hardware cycle that we got into on the last episode of the MacCast. A lot of people were a little bit upset when they learned that, you know, most Mac models have not been updated in over a year. It's gone over a year, with the exception of the iMac Pro. Every Mac model in Apple's lineup is at least a year old, if not longer, in the case of course, the Mac Pro, which has gone on since, 2013, and even worse, the Mac Mini, which is 2011. And I made the argument that I didn't know that it mattered so much anymore, at least not a year going by. I think that a lot of us were not upgrading our Mac hardware as frequently anymore. Of course, if you're that person that's going into a store at that moment and you're realizing you have to buy a year old hardware or wait, that can be a little bit of a tough call. But even then, modern processors year to year, yes, they get minor improvements, but we're not talking about the astronomical, like twice as fast kind of improvements, the whole Moore's Law thing that we have had been seeing in the past. And also, so I think there's kind of two things going on there. And I was kind of defending the slower upgrade cycle for computers. I don't think we need to do it as quickly anymore. And I threw it out to you and said, well, what do you think? And generally, most of you seem to agree with me. As a matter of fact, Craig wrote in, he says, I would say 99.9% of users would not notice a benefit outside of a battery bump for any Mac newer than 2012. He feels that a lot of the complaints are mostly coming from reviewers and enthusiasts, those of us who like to live on the bleeding edge, and we're making all the noise and clatter over the updates. But your average user, your general user, it's not that big a deal. They're walking into an Apple store and they're buying the machine that works for them with whatever technology is in it at the moment that's the best available that Apple is offering. And there's probably not too many complaints on that front. Not too many people are going down to that spec level and really realizing, oh, well, this is, last generation Intel's processor versus the one that came out 3 months ago. And that's just not going on. And I would say in a lot of cases that probably is true. Reviewers and tech enthusiasts, we care about this stuff a lot more, but the general public, maybe not quite as much. I think there's a limit to that though, right? Apple has to get a new machine out, I would imagine, at least every 18 months, 12 to 18 months. Like I said on the last episode of the MacCast, feels like the right range to me. Darren wrote in and he says, I'm typically on a budget when I'm buying my computers. I usually buy at the entry level when Apple releases products, so I am a little bit worried. It doesn't bother me that they're on this long upgrade cycle, but I'm worried for those models that are really, really long in the tooth, like the Mac Mini, because that's the machine that he would typically buy, or maybe the MacBook Air. Those models getting neglected means maybe Apple's thinking about discontinuing them. They might not go on. We've had that conversation about the Mac Mini. A ton of people love it, and Apple has said they're not going to get rid of it, but a lot of times when it goes on this long, it starts to feel like, well, it's neglect. Maybe they don't care about it anymore. And he notes that even his 2012 Mac Mini is still a, quote, great machine, kind of confirming what Craig was saying a little bit earlier, that, most people 2012 model and newer, they're pretty happy with it, happy with the performance. He has upgraded, Darren has upgraded his with an SSD and 16 gigs of RAM. And, he points out that dilemma of going into buy a new machine and only having options for older tech that can, frustrate some users. If you're going in and want to buy a Mac Mini and what you presented is something from 2014, that's pretty long in the tooth. You're going to want maybe something a little bit newer. And those two things, the fact that a lot of people upgrade their Mac Minis and the fact that the Mac Mini is getting pretty long in the tooth, got me thinking that, maybe the conversation we should have is not so much about the aggressive upgrade cycle or Apple updating machines yearly or even every 18 months. Maybe what needs to be happening is Apple returning to a point where we have some minimal ability to do upgrades on our hardware, right? That went away. But maybe if we're going to these points where we have longer and longer periods between new hardware coming out, maybe the way to bridge the gap for a lot of consumers is the ability to put in an SSD or a bigger SSD or some RAM. Not huge things, not like having to crack it open and put in a new GPU, but that would be nice too on some models. And some argue that, well, because of Apple's thin design, that's why they can't do that. I don't buy that. I think there's a lot of engineering talent at Apple, and I think they could figure out a way to design RAM upgradability into even something as slim as a MacBook or a MacBook Pro, even a MacBook Air, right? They can build slots in there. They can figure out a way to do it. And I think we probably do need to get back to that. And I think that would solve a lot of the frustration that some people are feeling. Now, not everybody, of course, agreed with me. Brian disagreed and, you know, said, no, it's not okay that Apple has ignored the Mac for this long. It's not okay that they're on a longer than 1 year upgrade cycle. He says, quote, in my opinion, they're treating the Mac hardware like a long lost son. He feels that Apple has really fallen out of love with the Mac, despite what they're saying, and that they're just too focused on the iPhone and iOS because that's their main source of revenue. It accounts for like 60% of their revenue. And he also says that just saying, quote, be happy with what you got, that's a poor excuse. You know, Apple needs to put out updates so that when a consumer's going in to buy a new Mac, they have a new model with new technology to choose from. And he says, you know, if the iPhone wasn't upgraded every year, there would be an uproar from the community and people would be screaming, you know, why haven't you updated this? This is ridiculous. And why should the Mac be any different? And Brian, I certainly see your point. You're right. I think that is a way to look at it. But I also think that we're really talking about two very different animals here when we're talking about how consumers buy and upgrade iPhones and iPads versus Mac. It's those consumer behaviors and consumer buying cycles. I think they're very, very different. For example, I think consumers are still at the point where they're upgrading their phones about every 2 years. It's typically a 2 year cycle. Some people go 3 years, but that's kind of the norm. With computers, it used to kind of be that cycle, I think, back in the day, but more and more, I think that's getting extended out, as I was talking about earlier. For me, I typically tried to own a Mac for about 5 years before I upgraded it. So that longer cycle, and arguably, that's getting even longer because of things like iPhones and iPads becoming supplemental computing devices for a lot of people. And they're very capable and fast devices. Apple has done an incredible job with the A-series processors, and software is getting more and more sophisticated for iPad and iPhone. And I think a lot of people are turning their computing tasks to those devices more frequently than even their computers. And so you're seeing these longer upgrade cycles, which just only supports, I think, Apple moving to a longer upgrade cycle for computers because people just aren't buying them that frequently. And that's kind of my argument. But I certainly see your point. And certainly, there's a lot of people in the community who also agree with you. But a bunch of great feedback from you on the Mac hardware upgrade cycle. If you still want to weigh in on this, I'm still opening up and welcoming your emails and your audio comments. Send those to maccast@gmail.com. And one other bit of follow-up, something we've been discussing on the last few episodes of the MacCast, is the whole subscription-based apps versus outright paid for apps. And I argued and have been saying I'm getting more and more used to the subscription model, and it's growing on me. I'm kind of liking it in some cases, and some of you don't feel the same way. And one of those big issues is, you know, what happens when I cancel my subscription? And, you know, what happens if I don't want to be on this constant cycle? Well, Brian wrote in to say he prefers developers who offer a little bit of a choice on how to subscribe. What he means is not subscribe versus buy, but a choice in the type of subscription you're able to purchase. He mentioned specifically monthly, yearly, and lifetime, which is something I've seen only in a few rare cases. As Brian pointed out, Plex offered a lifetime service, so you could pay in at a much higher price one time, and then you'd never have to pay again. You get upgrades for life, and that's an interesting way to go. I don't know that that's that as sustainable as the, you know, monthly or yearly subscription. I'm falling in the realm of, especially for the products that I use and would naturally just upgrade every year anyway when they had a paid upgrade. The yearly model seems to work best for me in most cases, where I pay once a year and then year goes around and then I pay again. So it might be $20 this year and then it's $20 next year. And especially for a critical utility app or productivity app that I'm using on a constant basis, I find value in that. And again, I think the value for the developer is they don't have to worry about waiting for these massive upgrade cycles to try and convince you, oh, you really need to buy this new version. They have sustainable income coming in on a regular basis, and so they can continually improve and update their products. And I'm seeing that with a lot of the products that I'm on subscriptions for. They get updated more frequently. They get more cool features added to them. They become better applications, I think, in a lot of ways because of the subscription model. But another listener also pointed out that this issue of, you know, what happens when you stop paying? And he said that he's noticing some app developers are offering subscriptions that would allow you to still lock in on an older version even after you stop paying. So this is typically, I've seen this typically done with the option where you're paying yearly and getting updates. So what'll happen is that once you stop paying, you get to continue to use the version that you have, but you just don't get access to any of the newer updates until you start paying again. So you can still use that software just like you would as if you had purchased it outright, but now you just won't get the updates. And I think that works pretty well. Also, I believe my Parallels subscription works like that. It's a yearly subscription, but if I stop paying, I can still use the version, whatever the last version I had was before I stopped paying. And I think that's kind of a good way to handle that, and it feels much more like the old days of just purchasing software outright. So I think we're going to figure all this subscription stuff out. It's getting more and more sophisticated, and I think developers are figuring out the price points and all that, and I think that's why subscription services are actually growing on me as a way for buying software. I don't think all software, again, it's a tool, it's a method for getting sustainable recurring revenue to developers, and it doesn't work for everything, but I think it works for a lot of things, and I think we're going to be seeing it a lot more. And I guess that was my ultimate point, is like, we're just going to have to get used to it. It is, as I said when it first started happening, it's the new app order, and I think that's the way forward for a lot of software. So get used to it. All right. Dave wrote in this week to express some concerns over iCloud Drive and iOS's new Files app. And I realized we hadn't gotten into this too much. He gave me a little history. He said he had sort of been waiting for the day on iOS when we would get a true, quote-unquote, true file system and syncing system that would allow him to sync across platforms, across devices, have nested folders, sort of like you did back in the, I was going to say iTools days, David, but no, back in like the mobile, was it Mobile Me when we had kind of a network drive that we could put stuff up into? Man, my Apple history is kind of failing me at this point. But you get the point. You know, some sort of online storage that would sync, go across devices, but you could have nested folders. It wasn't tied into a single app. And when the Files application came along, he thought, all right, here we are. This is it. Files in iCloud. Let me start trying to use this. And he began using it. But he wrote in to say, you know, I kind of got concerned because I saw the same file appearing in these new folders in the iCloud Drive in the Files application, and then also inside the Pages application in the iCloud Drive. And he started to worry, you know, is there possible file duplication going on? Are things being copied? How do I know which file is which version is the latest version? And so there was some confusion over, how is iOS and the Files application actually handling all this stuff? And I realized we hadn't really talked about that all that much. And David, I think when you hear all of this, you're going to be a little less worried about what's going on here. So you kind of have, I'm going to say, two different things going on, right? You have the Files app itself, which is the one application you can go on your iOS device and you can manage all your files. Typically, there's folders created for each one of your applications that taps into the file system, and developers have APIs available to them that Apple made available to tap into that. And there's a couple different ways they can do that. We don't probably need to get into that too much. There's a document manager, which is kind of the main way. And then there is also a thing called the document picker that they can do. And that works more like a share sheet. It's more for like one time you need to insert a file or a document into an application. And it's more of a copy kind of thing. Think of a common one would be adding an image, say, into a Keynote presentation, right? When you click that little button, it brings up the picker. Whereas if you want to open a Keynote document, that's when you're pressing the button and the document manager is coming up. Or as a matter of fact, I think the document manager comes up immediately the first time you launch the application, every time you launch the application, to help you find the file that you want to work on. So all of that stuff, the document picker and the document manager, all that ties back into the underlying files application. So even though you're inside the app itself, you're still kind of getting this view through the document manager. It's an operating system level thing that is managing all of those files. And then there is another part of that that relates to all of the cloud-based storage, and it is something called a file provider. Now, the file provider, you can kind of think of like a plugin that a cloud-based storage developer can write and add into their application to allow it to interact with and tap into the files application and basically make their cloud storage system available inside the files app. And so that's where you'll see over in the sidebar things like iCloud Drive. Apple has created a file provider built in for iCloud Drive, or you might have Box.net, or you might have Dropbox, or you might have blanking on Microsoft's software thing, but Microsoft 365 or Adobe Creative Cloud, whatever it might be. Any one of these guys can actually write a file provider and tap into the document manager. So anytime you're accessing that stuff, you are accessing it from a single location. So it is a single location. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to wind up with copies, because the last thing you need to know about all of this is that developers can implement that integration in two different ways. Now, the preferred way is something Apple calls open in place, and it allows apps to securely access and use files stored in another app or inside the document manager, inside the files application, directly from the location that they're sitting in. So even if that's Dropbox, or even if that's some other provider, or even if it's your iCloud Drive, what happens basically is that file is synced down to your local device and then opened in place and worked on. So you can work on that inside Pages. So say it's a Pages document, you can make all your changes and edits. That's going to get saved back into whatever cloud storage provider that is, be it iCloud or Dropbox or whatever it might be. And then through that service, it will get synced back across to all of your devices and stuff like that. And there is technology in there built in to handle things like conflicts and what happens if I've got it open in multiple places and there's multiple changes going on. Occasionally, I think with iWork documents, you might even see a pop-up or a dialogue that says, look, this has been changed in two places. Which is the file that you want? So it'll even help manage a lot of that stuff for you. But most of the time, you're not opening the same file on multiple devices at the same time and doing edits and stuff like that. But if that does happen, it's sort of managed. So if everything is implemented properly and supported by the developers and the cloud providers, then it should allow you to do all this stuff, and it should work, again, just like this ideal file and sync system that you're looking for. Now, that's the ideal situation. It doesn't necessarily mean the developers implement their solutions that way. But for iCloud, that's in Apple's own products like Pages and Numbers and stuff like that. That's how it pretty much works. You can work on those files in place, in location. They're going to sync. You will have a local copy to work with, but again, that will sync up later. And you can download that. You'll see in the files application, if you go into some of the cloud storage providers, they have that little cloud download icon. That just means this file's up in the cloud right now. If you'd like to, you know, grab a local copy, you can click on it. But it is stored in that location locally on your device. And just to avoid confusion, in the document manager, there also is another location, something called On My Device. That is different. That is outside what we're talking about here. So I'm talking about the fact that you're working directly in a document. So if something's stored in Pages and you go to another application that can read a Pages file, for example, and you use the document manager and you access that file that's in Pages in place, you know, with it open in place. And again, the developer controls whether it's open in place or open a copy, which actually creates a copy in the other application. So you might have to do a little research to find out how they're doing it. But again, Apple really encourages the open in place option. So it should be happening that way in most cases for most developers' apps. But even though you're reaching in and you're opening that Pages document from another file, if it's open in place, you're really editing the file where it sits inside the Pages application. And Apple has provided security controls and authentication tickets, and they handle this for you or for the developer at an operating system level. So they don't have to worry about it. And again, it's handling all of the file conflict issues and all that sort of stuff is managed by the operating system and the document manager that Apple has built and made available to developers. So that's that. But there is this thing called On My Device, and that location is only local to that device. So if you put files in there, they are accessible from the document manager, but they're not going to be synced across. They're not going to be accessible to other applications. They are just there on that device, just like it says, On My Device. So if you're doing that, just be aware of that. And then one last thing when it comes to the document manager and the file picker and stuff like that, one way to tell if an application is supporting the open in place or doing the open copy thing is once they've implemented integration with the document manager, you should be able to see that app also in the share sheet. So if you're in an application that supports that file type, so let's just say a Word document, right? So if you're in Word and you tap on the share sheet, you're going to see Pages as an option for an application that you can open that document in. You can do an open in. You might even be able to do open copy in. But if you just see the words open in, that means it's opening it up in that application but working on it in place. Whereas if you see a open copy, that means it's going to actually copy the application or copy the file to the host application and then open that copy of it for you to work on. So that is kind of the difference between whether or not an application does open in place or opens a copy of it. And as far as I know, that's the only way you can tell outside of maybe asking the developer which methodology they're supporting. But like I said, in general, I've been using iCloud and iCloud-supported apps a lot over the past few years, and in most cases I've had no issues with like multiple copies showing up places. It just doesn't happen very much anymore, and you really shouldn't have to worry about it too much, again, especially with Apple's own application. So if you're sticking to the iWork suite, you're going to be totally fine with this. Feel free to use iCloud Drive and the Files application and all that stuff, and I hope that kind of helps explain things and maybe answers some of the questions you might have. Maybe I've just opened up a bunch of other questions or concerns or confusion. And if I have, of course, send me emails, audio comments, maccast@gmail.com. All right. I listened to a podcast by a friend of mine, actually a couple friends of mine, Scott Johnson and Brian Ibbett. And it's called The Morning Stream, and it's over on the Frog Pants Network. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But thanks to these guys this week, they were doing a little segment. They do kind of a game show type segment. And one of the topics that was happening this week was the Muppet Show. And they got me thinking about the Muppet Show. And of course, I thought, you know, I want that. I know I have the DVDs stashed away somewhere. But I think they have the first three seasons out. I'd like to watch that. Is it on streaming? Nope, not on streaming anywhere. Can I buy it on iTunes? Nope, can't buy it on iTunes. Thank you, Disney Vault. God, I hate that thing. And so I thought, well, I'm going to have to resort to ripping my DVD copies into my digital media library. And I actually have two versions of my digital media library. I use iTunes, and I also have a Plex server. But that involved me having to, one, go find a CD-ROM DVD drive somewhere, a super drive, and then two, actually having to get into the process again of ripping DVDs, something I haven't done in a couple years. I did my whole library a few years back, but I haven't kind of come back to it. So I thought this was a good opportunity for me to share with you what I had to do and how I my process for ripping DVDs and getting them into iTunes, in case this is a project you want to get involved with and maybe haven't gotten to yet. So first thing, I had to get a super drive, right? So you can go out and you can buy a USB external CD-ROM drive or DVD drive, I guess I should say. Wow, I'm again showing my age. I told you I'm old, folks. But get an external DVD drive. You're going to want to look for one that is supported by macOS, because I know not all of them are supported out of the box. You might have to do some hacks. And as a matter of fact, with my solution, I thought I was going to have to do some hacks, because what I ended up doing was I ripped the super drive out of my old dead 2011 MacBook Pro and then just placed it in an external USB enclosure. Put that in there. And in the past, I used to have to go in and hack the property list file to get macOS to recognize it, but I plugged it in, and for whatever reason, macOS High Sierra, or Sierra, I'm not on High Sierra yet, macOS Sierra just recognized it. It was able to just mount, and it even launched the DVD player application when I put in the DVD. So that part solved. I was on to ripping, and my favorite software for ripping DVDs, because I think it is the easiest to use and the cleanest, is Mac DVD Ripper Pro. MacDVDRipperPro.com. I've been using that for years. I think it's about $24, $25 for the software, and I was happy to pay it, because you pop in the DVD, it recognizes it, it will typically find the tracks you want, and a lot of the anti-copying technology that's in there is they'll like tweak the tracks, and they'll put them around in weird locations or at weird points, and sometimes it's hard to tell. They actually do have a way where you can actually pick the tracks by going to the DVD menu, so you can bring it right up in the application, find the, just click on this is the track, and then you can hit a button, and it will actually find the exact track you're looking for. I know you can kind of tweak some of the settings and things like that, but I just use the defaults, which are the high-quality presets. And what I like about it, too, is you can go in there and it usually will detect and allow you to select and include the alternate audio tracks and also subtitle tracks. So I do all of that. You can also do batch processing. So in the case of the Muppet Show DVDs, obviously there are multiple episodes. I think they had six episodes on each DVD. I was able to select all of those at once and process and rip them and encode them in one batch. Now, it will allow you to do just the ripping. So if you want to use a separate encoder, if you prefer something like Handbrake or something like that, you can do that. Or even if you want to do it from the command line and get really nerdy. But like I said, the reason I like this software is because it's simple and easy to use. It's like one button click, and I am ripping and encoding my stuff, and it does a great job, in my opinion, with the encode. I'm sure if you want to get down to the technical nitty-gritty, you might be able to tweak it and get it better, but again, I'm looking for speed and simplicity here, and so just processes it right through, and it's really great. So Mac DVD Ripper Pro. And then the last step that I take before I get it into my media library is I want to add all of the metadata, the album art, the information on ratings and the episode descriptions and the cast and crew data and running times and all that sort of stuff. Of course, the album art, setting the correct media type and making sure it's, you know, labeled as a TV show or a movie, so it shows up in the right section inside iTunes. And the software that I use for that is iFlix 2, iFlixApp.com. Love, again, this software, again, because it is so simple. You just take the encoded video files out of Mac DVD Ripper Pro, drop them into iFlix 2. It goes out to all the databases, finds all of the data, populates it for you, goes out and gets the album art, populates that for you, and then you can go in and tweak it to your heart's content, and you can tweak just about every option and setting in there. You can select alternative album art, you can put in your own album art if you prefer to do it that way, and then you can have it write out the metadata. It will also do encoding, so if you want to have it encode and write out the metadata as well, that's an option. It has scripting you can do batch processing. It will also automatically, when it's done, add your items to your iTunes library if you want to do that. And you can also set up watch folders if you want to automate it. So you could actually have the folder that you're writing to from Mac DVD Ripper Pro automatically trigger and run your stuff in iFlix to add all of your metadata. So you can really automate the process. I do it a little bit more manually because I want a little bit of control. You can also go in with iFlix 2 and put in the chapter markers. So if you have a movie and you want all those chapter markers in there, what I found with that is it will typically find the time codes, but it doesn't all that frequently find the actual titles of those chapters. So I'm typically have to go out to the internet, find a website or service that has those, and copy and paste them in, which is a little bit time consuming. I wish it was a little bit better there, but that is probably my only complaint about iFlix 2. It works really, really great. So after I write out all the metadata, then I just grab the files, I take them and I throw them into my iTunes library. I also take them and copy them over to my Plex server, which I run on a Synology disk station, and that is awesome, and that I access with the Plex app on my Apple TV. So I have access to my full iTunes library, or my full media library, I should say, from my Apple TV. I can also access my iTunes library, but in that case, my Mac has to be on and iTunes has to be open and all that. So that's why I kind of have Plex as a backup, and it also serves as just a backup of all of my movie files and my media files, because I have them all in my iTunes library on my Mac, which of course gets backed up to Carbon Copy Cloner and also up to Backblaze, and then I also have them over on my Synology. So I have multiple copies locally at home, and then I have one copy of all of my media files in the cloud as well, because you know me, I'm crazy about the backup stuff, and I don't want to have to re-rip that stuff, because you hear that process that you have to go through? It's not overly complicated, but it is time-consuming. It took me, you know, over the weekend to convert, 76 tracks, 76 half-hour episodes of The Muppet Show, but now I have all of it there in my library and I can watch it whenever I want. It's probably what I'm going to be doing a little bit later. I love that show and it's really great and it holds up so well. Good family friendly fun. So if you've never caught an episode of The Muppet Show, you should check it out, although it's hard to find a copy because, you know, Disney doesn't want to sell it to us on digital for whatever reason. They want us to wait until they decide it's time for it to come out of the vault. Ugh, so frustrating. That could be a whole nother episode, so we won't get going on that. But that's my DVD ripping workflow. I'm sure you have one of your own, and if you have something that you think's a little bit better or different and that people might get some education from or maybe able to learn from, or if you have just tips or tricks for other tools or technology to help with the DVD ripping workflow, shoot me your emails, maccast@gmail.com. I'm gonna preempt one question. And the question that I will get is, well, what about Blu-rays, and I don't have any Blu-rays, but I know the bit of software that most people use for Blu-ray ripping, and I think you can use it for DVDs also, is called Make MKV. But to be honest, I've never found that software particularly easy to use. It's a little bit technical. It feels a little bit, again, like Handbrake, which it's not overly complicated, but it's not one button simple like DVD Ripper Pro is. That's my only point. So don't send me your angry emails about, you know, defense of Make MKV. But as far as I know, Make MKV is the only tool available for ripping your Blu-ray discs. Well, maybe there's other ones available, but that's the only one anybody ever tells me about when the subject comes up. So if you're looking for that, Make MKV. But that's how I do my DVD ripping. All right, last thing in the MacCast for today, and this is actually one other cool thing, especially if you're into music and multiple music subscription services. Diego wrote in to tell me about this really cool bit of software he found, but a little background on it before we get into it. He had made a comment actually in the MacCast Slack channel about frustrations with Apple Music recommendations and it getting polluted by some of the data of the songs his kids like to listen to. Now, he's got young kids. They don't have their own devices yet, and they want to hear music when, you know, they're driving around in the car, and it's typically not the same music that is Diego's favorite music. I think we've all been there. Anybody who's a parent knows how this goes. Well, that stuff gets in there, and it starts messing up your Apple Music recommendations, right? Because it's music that you don't particularly like, but now Apple Music suddenly thinks you like because you're listening to it. And so Diego was looking for a solution, like, how do I deal with this if I don't want to just have a family plan and have my kids on their own accounts yet? And so what he did was he thought, well, what if I just use a different music service outside of Apple Music for playing that stuff? And then I can keep my stuff in Apple Music, which is a service I really like, and keep that going. And so he started playing around and testing some other services, landed on Spotify. And what he found was that he really was enjoying Spotify's music recommendations or playlists a little bit better, recommended playlists a little bit better than the ones that he was finding in Apple. But he still preferred Apple Music for its overall quality, the service in general, the size of the catalog, of course, the integration, you know, being an Apple guy and a listener to the MacCast, the integration into all of his Apple stuff, Apple TV and HomePod and all those other things. So he didn't want to give that up, but he was really enjoying these playlists. And what he found was a really cool app called Songshift, songshiftapp.com. And he sent me the link to it, and I checked this out. And I think it was designed to really help you move from one service to another. So you're a Spotify user and you suddenly want to go to Apple Music and you've got all these Spotify playlists. You want to bring them over to Apple Music. This software will let you do that. It will basically transfer playlists from one service to another and vice versa. You can even use it with multiple services if you get the paid version. But for free, you can transfer your playlists between services. But better still is it has a feature if you pay the $4.99. So it's free to use with two different services to do the, you know, moving playlists from one service to another. But it has some advanced features that you can get if you pay for the application. And it's $4.99, not a subscription, just a one-time purchase. And once you do that, you can actually sync your playlists between services and multiple services. So it supports Apple Music, Spotify, Pandora, YouTube, Last.fm, Tidal, Deezer, Discogs, and Napster. So I think that covers all of the major services with the exception of Amazon, maybe. And you can sync your playlist between the services. And so this is what he found. And this works even with the free version of Spotify. So if you're on the free version of Spotify, you're listening, you're getting some recommendations, you really like the playlist recommendations that you're getting, you can fire up the Songshift application and tell it to take the playlist from Spotify and sync that over and put it in Apple Music. And the bonus here is that with the free version of Spotify, When you stream tracks over there, artists get paid a lot less than they do when you play the same track on Apple Music. So you can move that playlist over to Apple Music, get the higher quality, get all the features and integration of Apple Music, and the artist gets paid more. So it's like a win-win for everybody. And that was something that Diego liked about this service too. And I tried this thing out. Sign up was easy. The setting up the accounts and linking them, super simple. And it worked exactly as expected. I took a bunch of playlists I had left behind over on Spotify and Pandora and actually moved those over and now have them available in Apple Music. And I'm going to keep it linked up so that they actually sync, because I think they tweak those playlists on those other services over time. So I expect them to kind of update over time over on Apple Music, but I'm going to be listening to them on Apple Music. So great service, or great app rather, SongShift app, or SongShift app.com. Check it out. And Diego, thank you for sending that in, because I think it's a really cool app. All right, with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile. Check out PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro 10, available now, recently updated. Also, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen for iOS and iPad, Text Expander for iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. And don't forget to visit smilesoftware.com/blog to check out all of their anniversary blog posts. A little trip down memory lane. It's cool stuff. And if you're nostalgic about Apple and Mac stuff at all, well worth the read. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I want to hear from you. I want your comments, your questions, your feedback. Send those emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online between shows, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.